You know, my good friends of the left, well, actually, they're not my good friends. If you look at my Twitter account, you'd know that for a fact, have a mistaken idea about me. They think that I'm a Trump guy. And they say, you're President Trump. But really, you know, I was a Rand Paul guy. A Rand Paul guy for this reason. You could see the establishment cracking up on the right with the elevation and ascendancy of Trump. And now you can see the center Democratic left cracking up with the ascendancy of AOC and the Gang of Four. And I was thinking Rand Paul because he's the only one that was talking about something that's very dear to me, and that's the United States Constitution. Because without it, and without the rule of law, in a time of turmoil, especially in a time of turmoil, with the center collapsing and populism growing, we need that Constitution to remind us always what we're about, to keep our liberty against those in government who would misuse government and take power and misuse power, the awesome power of the federal hammer. You see it in Chicago all the time, and that's why I'm so pleased to have our guest, Andrew McCarthy, who's written an amazing book, Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy the Presidency. He talks about a meeting on January 5th, 2017, with Obama, President Obama, John Brennan, CIA, all the bosses of intelligence, James Comey, Clapper, all of them, Susan Rice, whom Obama sent out to lie for him repeatedly about Benghazi, to lie that it was Benghazi was promoted by a video. That video, it wasn't a video. That was on January 5th, 2017, and then they had to create a narrative. And on January 20th, Susan Rice, the known liar, had just become a private citizen. The clock had ticked January 20th. She's out 15 minutes after she was a private citizen, still in the White House. She types a memo about the meeting and says, we've done everything by the book. By the book? Who talks like that except someone who's covering their ass? We're going to talk to Andrew McCarthy about this Chicago Way takedown of the presidency and your government. And we're also going to talk to Ben Bradley of WGN, who has this amazing tale about Larry Dominick, the boss of Cicero, who doesn't like getting subpoenas served on him, and sending the Cicero cops to arrest the subpoena server, going into his house without a warrant, allegedly, to muscle the man's wife. All because Larry Dominick doesn't want to talk about what he did to help Michael Madigan. Yeah, Boss Madigan. Jeff Carlin is here as always. Executive producer of the Rokan Show with Anna DeVellantis. And my buddy and former goalkeeper. And me, I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, a member of its editorial board. And you, thinking about the Constitution, I hope, and the Republic, and what it means to be herded by experts who twist your mind like you're in a John Le Carré novel. And you don't know where to turn, you're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
The reason I want you to read this book by Andy McCarthy, Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency, is not about having talking points. It's not about having debate points to deflect criticism or win a argument. This is about your republic. This is about the Constitution. This is about abuse of power. And what we see in the book, excellently written, I can't wait to review it in my column, is a Chicago Way takedown. Just like they did in the old days in Chicago, when the mayor of Chicago wanted to nail an alderman, he'd gather his top cops together, including Bill Hanhart, the outfit's top cop, who was also chief of detectives. They'd get together and they'd put together a dossier on an alderman, and that dossier would find its way to one of those old-time newspaper reporters at City Hall, and the guy's career would be destroyed. This is like this, except it's your government, your national government, our federal government, the presidency. And so, without further ado, Andrew McCarthy, author of Ball of Collusion. Good day, Andy. Thanks for being here.
Great to talk to you, John. Thank you so much for having me.
If we could, I'd like to start with a meeting that you mention, January 5th, 2017. The top, Obama is there, President Obama from Chicago, understands the Chicago way. Susan Rice is there, the liar of Benghazi. John Brennan is there. James Comey, Clapper, I think a few others. What are they talking about at that meeting, Andy?
Well, the point of the meeting, at least ostensibly, was to brief President Obama on the intelligence community assessment of Russia's meddling in the 2016 election, which is an assessment that President Obama ordered in December of 2016 and essentially put Brennan, who was the head of the CIA, in charge of. And the timing is significant because it's the day before they are supposed to go up to New York to Trump Tower and brief President to a then President-elect Trump on the same information. And the most interesting part of the session is that after the main part of the briefing is over, President Obama convenes a smaller group consisting of himself, Vice President Biden, and National Security Advisor Rice on the political side. And then on the law enforcement / intelligence side, FBI Director Jim Comey and then acting Attorney General Sally Yates, who are the two top law enforcement / intelligence officials who are actually staying on in the new administration. And it appears that the point of that meeting is to discuss the ongoing Russia-Trump investigation, and specifically what information should be withheld from the incoming Trump team about that investigation. And I'm pretty convinced, John, that the whole point here was to try to figure out how they could sustain the investigation, how they could continue and keep it going, despite the fact that Trump was soon going to be in power and as president would be in a position to shut it down. So the challenge they had before them was how to sustain it under those circumstances.
And they had to create a narrative that would cover their tracks about what they'd done.
Yeah, I think that once Mrs. Clinton lost, which was shocking to all of them, they had 10 weeks where they were still going to be in charge of the government. And I think they decided to use those 10 weeks between intelligence leaks and other stuff that was done to make it appear that there was something really significant to investigate here.
In your book, and I've written about it as well, so have many, on January 20th, 20 minutes or 15 minutes after the liar Susan Rice was no longer officially a government official. She wrote a memo on White House, you know, on White House servers, saying that we've done everything by the book. My question, as a lawman, a prosecutor, who talks like that?
Well, you certainly don't need to say that someone reminded us all that we have to do everything by the book if you're dealing with people who've been doing things by the book for 8 years, right? You don't have to tell people who are by the book people that they need to do things by the book. But I think that coupled with the timing of the memo is very peculiar. This purports to be a contemporaneous memorandum of a meeting, but of course it's not. It's a meeting that Rice writes about when she's actually not even officially in the government anymore. So it's 15 minutes after her president is out of power, and she is thus out of power, even though she's still opportunistically in a position to write an email and get it into the system. And what she's trying to do is paper a meeting that happened 2.5 weeks before. And the reason is, I think they were very concerned about the meeting. That's the January 5th meeting, because there had been tumultuous developments in the ensuing 2.5 weeks, not least the leaking of the entire Steele dossier by CNN and BuzzFeed, which made it pretty obvious that they had shared only a small sliver of information with Trump about the ongoing Trump-Russia investigation.
And Andy, the introduction of the book starts like this. This is a story about hubris. And I think that is the most poignant piece of anything that anybody ever has talked about in this situation. And John and I have talked about this in the past. But it's the idea that these people thought that it was their right to control the future of the government. And it was their honor to do it. You speak a little bit about that, because everyone throws out the word collusion, but as you point out, it's really, there's plenty of collusion, sure, but that's really the heart of the situation.
Yeah, I think this is why and how people who, I think, start out with the best of intentions to try to protect the country get to the point where they forget that what the country is about is a self-determining people that has a government that is supposed to serve the people. And, you know, the turnaround here is that the high officials think that, you know, they are a government that happens to have a people that's, you know, associated with it, but they're the ones who know best about what's best for the country. And it just seems that if you look closely at especially the paper trail of communications between the investigators in this case, both on the intelligence side and the law enforcement side, what you come away with is they decided that they didn't believe that Donald Trump was fit to be president. And, you know, there's a lot of things that you can say about Donald Trump, good and bad, but, you know, ultimately the way this system works is we have elections and each side gets to bring out whatever information that it can about the flaws of the other side, and then we leave it to the public to vote on it. We don't have the FBI and the CIA as kind of a check on the public. They're supposed to play the hand that the public deals, because we're a self-determining people. And I think what happened here is they just decided that their judgment about who was fit to be president was superior to the public's, and they weren't going to take the public's determination for an answer.
We're talking to Andrew McCarthy on the Chicago Way. If you like what you're hearing, find us on iTunes, write us a review, and tell your friends. Now, one thing I've noticed about the people I know well in the FBI and intelligence is that the line people are firmly and honestly concerned about constitutional issues. They're the ones who are worried about the Fourth Amendment. They're worried about abuse of power. They don't want an abuse of power. That's at least my experience in it. And as a law enforcement man yourself, people see you on Fox or they read your articles, they should know that you spent many, many years in New York as a United States prosecutor for the U.S. Attorney's Office, and you worked on terrorism and other issues. Is that concern about the Constitution reflected in the remarks on page 195 of Ball of Collusion? There's an email from Lisa Page, the counsel to Andrew McCabe, deputy director of the FBI at the time. Hey, if you have one opportunity to discuss further with Andy, please convey the following. She, Hillary Clinton, might be our next president. The last thing we need is us going in there loaded for bear when it is not operationally necessary. You think she's going to remember or care if it was more than that? I'm sorry, start over. You think she's going to remember or care that it was more DOJ than FBI? This is as much about reputational protection as anything. And obviously, they thought Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president, and they were going to protect her and kowtow to her. She's telling them to not go after Hillary on the email servers. What does that tell you about the upper echelons as opposed to the line people in Department of Justice and the FBI?
Well, what you've hit on here is what I think the central failing was of these two interrelated investigations, the Clinton emails investigation and the Trump-Russia investigation. When things are operating as they're supposed to operate, the FBI and the Justice Department want investigations to be conducted in the field offices and the federal districts out in the country where either the crime occurs or the threat to the country exists. For one thing, that's consistent with the Constitution. But the other thing that's very important is it gives the people who are doing the investigation insulation from the political environment of Washington. And it also allows headquarters to perform its necessary role of providing both supervision and the enforcement of the standards that the Justice Department and the FBI operate under. And I think what went very wrong here is that the supervisors, the headquarters people, got out of that supervisory role and took upon themselves the role of actually doing the investigation, with all of the infection of Washington politics that implies because they're at headquarters, and without supervision for themselves, which means when they pushed the envelope and did things that they shouldn't do, there was nobody at an upper level there to tell them no, to tell them that, you know, that's not the way that we're supposed to operate here. So if you saw a communication like the one you just read in a normal case, you would be appalled by it, as we should be, but you'd also figure that the adult supervision would jump in and explain to the people who were involved in the investigation, you know, no, we don't do that. We tune the politics out, and we keep our eye focused on where the laws have been violated. And we don't have two tiers of justice. We treat everybody the same. But here, what happened is the people who should have been giving that advice took on the role of investigators, and they were just as susceptible as any investigator is to the kinds of pressures that exist in an investigation, and because they were headquarters, to the kinds of pressure that you get from Washington politics.
For years, I've been referring to these types of people in the administrations and in the establishment, both Republican and Democrat, as Kemalists, as the Turkish bureaucrats and military intelligence people who were trying to protect Kemal Ataturk in Turkey from his enemies and ran roughshod over everyone. And I'm so glad that you referred to this in your book. Not that you're referring to me, of course, you're referring on your own. But the question is, now that William Barr, the Attorney General is investigating, and Horowitz is investigating, and that's to be coming out soon, which is why I think your book is so invaluable now. What do you think will come of the Kemalists in the administration?
Well, my modest hope, and I say this as somebody who has great confidence in Attorney General Barr, I think he really does grasp the need that the government has to not only hold people accountable, but to be seen as holding people accountable. And I do think he's committed to getting to the bottom of what happened here. My modest hope for what we'll get at the end of the day is an accurate, actual account of what happened here and why. Now, I know a lot of people want to know or have hope because of what they assume happened here, that there are going to be massive prosecutions involving people who made the judgment calls here. And I think that gets way ahead of where we are now. What I hope we do is we actually get an accounting of what happened, which means we get all the things that have been withheld for the last 2.5 years into the light of day. And if it turns out that people violated the law and they made misrepresentations to the FISA court or whatever else they did, we can deal with that at the time. But in terms of our body politic, the most important thing is we have to be able to show that the government can be trusted with these enormous counterintelligence powers because they're essential to protecting the country. But if the government can't hold people accountable when they run afoul of the rules, then I think the public through Congress is going to demand that these powers get either repealed or cut back drastically. And I'm much more concerned, John, about the possibility that we won't be able to use them for what they're necessary for, which is protecting the government against foreign threats to American national security or protecting the public. If we don't have these powers, we can't really do the kind of job that has to be done to defend the country. So to me, that's the most important thing. We have to find out what happened. We have to put in whatever reforms in law are necessary and our procedures are necessary to make sure these powers never again get exploited in a political context and that they're used for what they're there for.
In your book, you're the first, I think, to actually put this in the lap of Barack Obama. I mean, that was difficult because you began writing this before this thing, even before the Mueller report came out. But based on your own understanding and analysis of the systems and little things like, I mean, not little things, monumental things like the president yeah. asks Brennan for an assessment and it's ready in days rather than in you know, months and months, as anyone who understands CIA understands. But you say the collusion wasn't Trump-Russia, but was really Obama, Brennan, Comey, etc.
I think they put the law enforcement, I think the president, Obama, put the law enforcement and intelligence apparatus of the government at the service of the Clinton campaign, and it was done for political reasons. And the reason I think it shouldn't be controversial to point the finger at President Obama, because if things are working the way they're supposed to work, counterintelligence is done for the president. There's no other reason to do it. So, you know, the FBI has two missions, right? They have a criminal law enforcement mission. That's not for intelligence gathering purposes. That's to vindicate the rule of law in judicial proceedings. You know, they're enforcing congressional statutes. So, you know, we don't want politics to intrude on who gets prosecuted. By contrast, the only reason you do counterintelligence is to support the president's national security mission to protect the country from foreign threats. And obviously that's done for the president. Here we have lots of indication that he knew about, was kept informed about, and monitored what was going on in the investigation. And as I wrote long before I wrote the book, if there really was a belief, an authentic, good faith belief, that you had a presidential candidate who was actually in cahoots with a hostile foreign country, it would not only be permissible, it would be the obligation of the president to investigate that. So, you know, the way they set this up, obviously Obama had to be involved in it, but that means if it was done for political reasons rather than good faith national security reasons, he's got to own that as well.
Andrew McCarthy's book, Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. You must read it. Everyone who's listening to me and will read my column in the Chicago Tribune must read this soon, not to have ammunition in a debate, but to understand what's going on in your government, in this republic, if we can keep it. Andrew McCarthy, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you, gents. I really enjoyed it.
So bye-bye to the collusion lie. Collusion obsession gave the press a black eye. And if they persist, the damage will amplify. Time to let it go and just let it die.
I keep telling you that the Chicago Way can also run on Cermak Road. Between the old Lexington Hotel on Michigan Avenue all the way out to Cicero. It was named after Cermak, killed by the outfit, Mayor Anton Cermak, and Paul the Waiter Rica, when he'd have his drivers drive him back and forth, would look up at those signs and street signs and laugh and laugh. You think Cicero's changed much? It hasn't. They still don't like subpoenas out there. And Ben Bradley of WGN News, our friend, has a great story about the Cicero Way. Although I hear he wants his own theme song. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, I'd like a theme song similar to Casso down by the river, narrated by Rick Kogan. I think it would be perfect. And in fact, I'm calling my agent. I'm not coming on this podcast again until I have my own theme song.
All right, mister. Tell me what happened.
So this is a story about what happens when you take on House Speaker Mike Madigan in a lawsuit and you try to get one of his cronies to testify. A process server was hired to serve Cicero Town President Larry Dominick with a subpoena to testify in this ongoing lawsuit against House Speaker Mike Madigan. This is the suit from Jason Gonzalez, who challenged Madigan for re-election, and he accuses the House Speaker of running sham candidates with Hispanic last names against him to try to dilute the vote. That would never happen, would it, John?
Actually, it did happen. I've written about that, and I interviewed him, and yeah, it did happen.
Exactly. You know all too well about some of the tactics that go on in local politics. So they tried to get Larry Dominick to testify because he's, you know, an ally of Madigan. So this poor process server, and for those who aren't familiar, the process server is the guy who goes out and finds people who don't want to be found and hands them the papers and says, you've been served. You've got to, you know, show up on this date and testify. This process server does what they do, which is they go into a database, they look for last known addresses. He came up with a couple of possible addresses for the Cicero Town president, but he started at Cicero Town Hall, where he introduced himself, said that he had court papers to serve Larry Dominick, and they said, oh, no, he's not here. Try at this address. So the process server goes to the address. No one answers the door, but there's a package on the stoop. He says he picks it up to see if Larry Dominick's name is on the package. And then he says he puts it down, goes on his way to check out a couple other addresses. Lo and behold, he checks out a couple addresses. And a day or two later, he's doing the same thing in Cicero, and he gets pulled over. And before it's all done, seven cops have arrived at the scene. One of them gets on the phone, is in a conversation with someone, and then barks the order, arrest him. And this process server spent a day and a half in the Cicero jail and winds up getting charged with package theft and impersonating a police officer because he had a badge around his neck that identified him as a process server.
When we caught up with Dominick, he had a different take on the matter.
Why did he go to the wrong house and take a package? You see it all the time on the news. People are stealing packages. Just because he's a process server don't mean he's above the law.
Hey, you guys really take package theft seriously in Cicero.
We take everything serious. That's why our crime is so low lately.
But you're honestly telling me seven cops arresting a process server,
it's not my
trying
department.
To serve the town president, no coincidence there?
None.
Your cops supposedly told him that the town president can't be served.
That's not true. That's not true at all. Yeah. Everyone knows that could be served.
Dominic was eventually deposed in the lawsuit against Mike Madigan.
Motion by Trustee Verrusso.
In that deposition, he denied knowing anything about the House Speaker's alleged political ploys. You play no role in Mike Madigan's machine.
No, he's much more powerful than me. What do I have to do with him? He's a friend of mine, but I have nothing to do with Mike Madigan's machine.
Now, one thing, those coppers, do they all smell like Aqua Velva? I'm just thinking. You know, the aftershave. So then,
I don't know if it's Aqua Velva or what. But
Aqua Velva and garlic, I bet. Yeah.
Yeah. As I said to Larry Dominic when we caught up to him to ask him about it, and he contended that this process server, you know, this wasn't because he was trying to serve me. This was because he stole a package, which, by the way, a judge found him not guilty of. I said, Mr. Dominic, you all seem to take package theft very seriously in this town. Seven cops, they, through a Freedom of Information Act request, turned over all their evidence to us, which consisted of surveillance video from gas stations and one of those doorbell cameras and on and on and on. The images did show the process server picking up the box, but not taking it.
I want to ask questions about Mike Madigan and Larry Dominic.
What's especially, I think, troubling is, as we reported, the harassment of this process server has not ended. Even though they dropped the charge of impersonating a police officer because he had a process server badge, you know, no different from if you're a private, you know, security guard, they give you a badge. And then the judge found him not guilty on the package theft. The harassment has not ended for this guy. He says he continues to receive letters in his home mailbox from people who say, how dare you challenge us? We're coming after you. We know where you live. And a note about those letters, the spelling is terrible.
And speaking of his home, wasn't there some sort of searching and possible seizing sort?
Yeah, Jeff, I'm glad you reminded me, because as the process server was being held overnight in the Cicero jail and interrogated over this alleged package theft, Cicero cops went to his home on the southwest side of Chicago and raided his home. They woke up his wife at 4 o'clock in the morning and allegedly said, we're here looking for the package that William stole. And as the process server's wife has related, these guys went through the house and finally and demanded that she turn over something, anything, and she gave him a bag. And then that's what the Cicero police said he stole.
And they did this without, I'm assuming, CPD help? Chicago police help?
I don't know whether Chicago police was notified that they were going to the house or not. I can tell you, according to the federal lawsuit that's now been filed against the town of Cicero, there was not a search warrant.
Just to be clear and to say again, Cicero cops went into Chicago, knocked on the door, and searched and muscled their way in. The wife was home. And searched a house without a search warrant, right? Is that what you're saying?
That's the allegation in the lawsuit, yes.
So this alleged package that's missing or was taken from Mr. Dominic, I wonder what package he's missing that may have something very valuable or important in it that he's so excited
well,
about.
That's where, and we didn't get into this on TV because this story's got more twists and turns than a telenovela. The package and the home that popped up in this database search turned out to belong to Sam Jellick, who is the Cicero Streets and Sand Commissioner and another ally of Larry Dominic. So you have one town official allegedly claiming that he was the victim of this package theft.
You know, if I think that Larry Dominick should put a sign over his head, a neon sign saying, U.S. Attorney, please come talk to me, send the FBI. Because that's what you did.
Here.
Larry, that's what you've just done. You've just done that.
I can remember as a Cub reporter, you know, in Chicago 20-plus years ago, you've been camped out in Cicero for weeks on end covering Betty Lou and Maltese. Yeah. The entire insurance scam that she ended up going to prison for.
You know, she went.
And ultimately,
she went to...
this is taxpayers who pay for this kind of stuff. And it's interesting to me that Cicero has continued to elect, somebody who, at least on the surface, is not representative of the community, right? You know, that's a supermajority Hispanic community these guys have managed to maintain power in. Not that different from how Madigan and Burke have maintained power in wards where the demographics have shifted on them. Not that demographics are the only indication of how somebody votes, but it is unusual.
I remember sharing smokes with Betty Lauren Maltese, and it was right before she was going to prison. Took a big drag. She had that blue eyeshadow,
Oh, I remember it well.
And she sighs it out and says, you know what, John? I guess I must be some stubborn Lithuanian. I thought, you know what? That's just perfect. And then she ended up, I think there was a cookie jar at her home with, some woman was taking care of her daughter, and it kept getting remarkably filled. The cookie jar got filled with cookies, but the cookies had dead presidents on them. And
I'm familiar with that.
You know,
type of cheese.
I always wondered if Eddie Verdoliak was a cookie man. You know, but that's another story. This one is just amazing that they would send cops to muscle this guy
at 4 in the morning. Under the cover of night. Jeez.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of a town taking package theft this seriously?
Well,
Amazon must be worried.
I think I have, but you know what? It's Cicero.
Yeah. I was joking about the story. I was reading it, and Ben was sending me notes on it. And I was thinking to myself, this is the Justice Department. Do they have like a Cicero bureau that they just had forever since the days of Capone? And they go back to, they blow the dust off of it. And they're like, all right, let's go back to work on these guys.
Ben Bradley, WGN, with the amazing Cicero Way story of Larry Dominick and the muscling of a man trying to serve a subpoena, finding out about Michael Madigan. Just brilliant and beautiful. Love that story, Ben. Thanks for being
here.
Thanks.
Always good to be with you guys.
See you, buddy.
Thanks, Ben.
Did you like what you heard today? I did. I liked doing it, and so did Jeff. But if you liked what you heard, find us on iTunes, subscribe, or with any other, find us on iTunes or subscribe anywhere you find free podcasts. This is a free podcast. Write us a kick-ass review. Yeah, I want 5-star reviews. And you know why? Because the more reviews we get, the more reach we get. You can help us reach more people. The Chicago Way is like one place where you can get stuff that you're not getting anywhere else. I'm sorry, it's not just my loving personality and my charm, like I'm like Clifton Webb and Mr. Belvedere. No, I don't think so. And it's not my voice, is it? My Chicago voice, although it's not fake like that guy with the coyote. It's real Chicago. So find us on iTunes, subscribe, tell them why, and we'll love you for it. For Andy McCarthy of the National Review, the former prosecutor himself, and his book, Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. For Ben Bradley, WGN News tells that great story about Cicero and Larry Dominick and guys serving subpoenas and how we don't want no subpoenas nobody sent. For Jeff Carlin of WGN Radio, the executive producer of the Rokan Show with Anna DeVellantis. And for me, John Cass, as always, priorities first, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, of course nationally syndicated, and member of its august editorial board. You've been on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.